A long time, 10 years. Glass thought about the snake, surviving, thriving for a decade on the strength of its brutal attributes. And then a single mistake, a moment of exposure in an environment without tolerance. Dead and devoured almost before its blood ceased to pump. He cut the rattles from the remains of the snake and fingered them like a rosary. After a while, he dropped them into his possibles bag. When he looked at them, he wanted to remember. It was dark. Glass pulled his blanket around him, hunched his back, and fell asleep. He awoke thirsty and hungry from a fitful sleep. Every wound ached. 350 miles to Fort Kiowa. He knew he couldn't allow himself to think about it, not in its totality. A mile at a time. He set the Grand as his first goal. He'd been unconscious when the brigade veered off the main river up the Spring Creek, but from Bridger and Fitzgerald's discussions, he assumed it lay near. Glass pulled the Hudson Bay blanket from his shoulders. With a razor, he cut 3 long strips from the wool cloth. He wrapped the first around his left knee, his good knee. He would need a pad if he was going to crawl. The other 2 strips he wrapped around his palms, leaving the fingers free. He rolled up the rest of the blanket and looped the long strap of the possibles bag around both ends. He checked to make sure the bag was tied firmly shut, then situated the bag and blanket across his back. The strap he wore around both shoulders, leaving his hands free. Glass took a long drink from the creek and began to crawl. Actually, it wasn't a crawl, so much as a scooting sort of drag. He could use his right arm for balance, but it would not support his weight. His right leg he could only string along behind him. He had worked to loosen the muscles by bending and straightening the leg, but it remained as rigid as a flagpole. He fell into the best rhythm he could manage. With his right hand as a sort of outrigger, he kept his weight on his left side, leaning forward on his left arm, pulling up his left knee, then dragging his stiff right leg behind him. Over and over, yard after yard. He stopped several times to adjust the blanket and the possibles bag. His herky-jerky motion kept loosening the ties of his pack. Eventually, he found the right series of knots to keep the bundle in place. For a while, the wool strips on his knee and palms worked fairly well, though they required frequent adjustment. He had failed to consider the effect of dragging his right leg. His moccasin provided protection to the lower part of his foot, but did not cover his ankle. Within 100 yards, he had developed an abrasion and stopped to cut a strip of blanket for the area in contact with the ground. It took him almost 2 hours to crawl down the creek to the Grand. By the time he arrived at the river, his legs and arms ached from the awkward, unaccustomed motion. He stared down at the old tracks of the brigade and wondered by what providence the Indians had not seen them. Though he would never see it, the explanation lay clearly on the opposite bank. Had he crossed the river, he would have found the enormous prints of a bear spread throughout a patch of service berries. Just as clear were the tracks of the 5 Indian ponies. In an irony that Glass would never appreciate, it was a grizzly bear that saved him from the Indians. Like Fitzgerald, the bear had discovered the berry patch near the Grand. The animal was gorging itself when the 5 Arikara warriors rode up the river. In fact, it was the scent of the bear that had made the Pinto skittish. Confused by the sight and smell of 5 mounted Indians, the bear lumbered into the brush. The hunters charged after it, never to notice the tracks on the opposite bank. Once Glass emerged from the protective shelter of the pines, the horizon broadened in a landscape broken only by rolling buttes and scattered clumps of cottonwoods. Thick willows along the river impeded his ability to crawl forward, but did little to block the penetrating heat of the late morning sun. He felt the rivulets of sweat across his back and chest and the sting of salt when it seeped into his wounds. He took 1 last drink from the cool spring creek. He gazed upriver between swallows, giving one last consideration to the idea of direct pursuit. Not yet. The frustrating necessity of delay was like water on the hot iron of his determination, hardening it, making it unmalleable. He vowed to survive, if for no other reason than to visit vengeance on the men who betrayed him. Glass crawled for 3 more hours that day. He guessed he had covered 2 miles. The Grand's banks varied with alternating stretches of sand, grass, and rock. Had he been able to stand, there were frequent stretches of shallow water, and Glass could have crossed the river frequently to take advantage of the easiest terrain. But crossing was not an option for Glass, whose crawling relegated him to the north bank. The rocks created particular difficulty. By the time he stopped, the woolen pads were in tatters. The wool succeeded in keeping abrasions from forming, but it could not stop the bruising. His knee and his palms were black and blue, tender to the touch. The muscle in his left arm began to cramp, and once again he felt the quivering weakness from a lack of food. As he anticipated, no easy source of meat fell into his path. For the time being, his subsistence would have to come from plants. From his time with the Pawnee, Glass possessed a broad familiarity with the plants of the plains. Cattails grew in plentiful clumps wherever the terrain flattened to create marshy backwaters, their furry brown heads capping slender green stalks as high as 4 feet. Glass used a stave to dig up the rootstocks, peeled away the outer skin, and ate the tender shoots. While cattails grew thickly in the marsh, so too did mosquitoes. They buzzed incessantly around the exposed skin on his head, neck, and arms. He ignored them for a while as he dug hungrily among the cattails. Eventually, he gnawed the edge off his hunger, or at least fed his hunger sufficiently that he worried more about the stinging bites of the mosquitoes. He crawled another 100 yards down the river. There was no escaping the mosquitoes at that hour, but their numbers diminished away from the stagnant water of the marsh. For 3 days, he crawled down the Grand River. Cattails continued to be plentiful, and Glass found a variety of other plants that he knew to be edible. Onions, dandelions, even willow leaves. Twice he happened upon berries, stopping each time to gorge himself, picking until his fingers were purple from the juice. Yet he did not find what his body craved. It had been 12 days since the attack by the grizzly. Before he was abandoned, Glass had swallowed a few sips of broth on a couple occasions. Otherwise, the rattler had been his only real food. Berries and roots might sustain him for a few days. To heal, though, to regain his feet, Glass knew he needed the rich nourishment that only meat could provide. The snake had been a bit of random luck, unlikely to be repeated. Still, he thought, there was no luck at all in standing still. The next morning, he would crawl forward again. If luck wouldn't find him, he would do his best to make his own. 9. September 8th, 1823. He smelled the buffalo carcass before he saw it. He heard it, too, or at least he heard the clouds of flies that swirled around the heaping mass of hide and bone. Sinews held the skeleton mostly intact, although scavengers had picked it clean of any meat. The massive bushy head and swooping black horns lent the animal its only measure of dignity, though this too had been undermined by the birds that had picked away the eyes. Looking at the beast, Glass felt no revulsion, only disappointment that others had beaten him to this potential source of nourishment. A variety of tracks surrounded the area. Glass guessed that the carcass was 4 or 5 days old. He stared at the pile of bones. For an instant, he imagined his own skeleton scattered across the bleak ground on some forgotten corner of prairie, his flesh eaten away, carrion for the magpies and coyotes. He thought about a line from scripture, "Dust to dust. Is this what it means?" His thoughts turned quickly to more practical considerations. He had seen starving Indians boil hides into a gluey, edible mass. He would willingly have attempted the same, except he had no vessel to contain boiling water. He had another thought. The carcass lay next to a head-sized rock. He picked it up with his left hand and threw it clumsily against the line of smaller ribs. One of the bones snapped, and Glass reached for one of the pieces. The marrow, he sought, was dry. I need a thicker bone. One of the buffalo's forelegs lay apart from the rest, bare bone down to the hoof. He laid it against a flat stone and began to beat on it with the other rock. Finally, a crack appeared, and then the bone broke. He was right, the thicker bone still contained the greenish marrow. In hindsight, he should have known not to eat it by the smell, but his hunger robbed him of reason. He ignored the bitter taste, sucking the liquid from the bone, then digging for more with the piece of broken rib. Better to take the risk than to die of starvation. At least the marrow was easy to swallow. Frenzied by the idea of food, but the very mechanics of eating, he spent the better part of an hour breaking bones and scraping their contents. About then, the first cramp hit. It began as a hollow aching deep inside his bowels. He felt suddenly incapable of supporting his own weight and rolled to his side. The pressure in his head became so intense that Glass was aware of the very fissures in his skull. He began to sweat profusely. Like sunlight through glass, the pain in his abdomen became quickly more focused, burning. Nausea rose in his stomach like a great and inevitable tide. He began to retch. The indignity of the convulsions secondary to the excruciating pain as the bile passed his wounded throat. For 2 hours, he lay there. His stomach emptied quickly, but did not cease to convulse. Between bouts of retching, he was perfectly still, as if through lack of motion, he could hide from the sickness and pain. When the first round of sickness was over, he crawled away from the carcass, eager now to escape the sickeningly sweet smell. The motion reignited both the pain in his head and the nausea in his stomach. 30 yards from the buffalo, he crawled into a thick stand of willows, curled onto his side, and lapsed into a state that resembled unconsciousness more than sleep. For a day and a night, his body purged itself of the rancid marrow. The focused pain of his wounds from the grizzly now combined with a diffuse and permeating weakness. Glass came to visualize his strength as the sand in an hourglass. Minute by minute, he felt his vitality ebbing away. Like an hourglass, he knew a moment would arrive when the last grain of sand would tumble down the aperture, leaving the upper chamber void. He could not shake the image of the buffalo skeleton, of the mighty beast stripped of its flesh, rotting away on the prairie. On the morning of the second day after the buffalo, Glass awoke hungry. Ravenously hungry. He took it as a sign that the poison had passed from his system. He had tried to continue his laborious crawl downriver, in part because he still hoped to stumble across some other source of food, but more because he sensed the significance of stopping. In 2 days, he estimated that he had covered no more than a quarter mile. Glass knew that the sickness had cost him more than time and distance. It had sapped him of strength, eaten away at whatever tiny reservoir remained to him. Without meat in the next few days, Glass assumed that he would die. His experience with the buffalo carcass and its aftermath would keep him away from anything not freshly killed, no matter how desperate he grew. His first thought was to make a spear or to kill a cottontail with a stone, but the pain in his right shoulder kept him from raising his arm, let alone thrusting it hard enough to generate a lethal throw. With his left hand, he lacked the accuracy to hit anything. So hunting was out. That left trapping. With cordage and a knife to carve triggers, Glass knew a variety of ways to trap small game with snares. Lacking even those basics, he decided to try deadfalls. A deadfall was a simple device, a large rock leaning precariously on a stick, rigged to collapse when some unwary prey tripped a trigger. The willows along the Grand were zigzagged with game trails. Tracks dotted the moist sand near the river. In the tall grass, he saw the swirling depressions where deer had bedded down for the night. Glass considered it unlikely that he could trap a deer with a deadfall. For one thing, he doubted he could hoist a rock or tree of sufficient heft. He decided to set his sights on rabbits, which he encountered continuously along the river. Glass looked for trails near the thick cover preferred by rabbits. He found a cottonwood downed recently by beaver, its leaf-covered branches creating a giant web of obstacles and hiding places. The trails leading to and from the tree were littered with pea-sized scat. Near the river, Glass found three suitable stones, flat enough to provide a broad surface for crushing when the trap was tripped, heavy enough to provide lethal force. The stones he selected were the size of a powder keg and weighed about 30 pounds each. With his crippled arm and leg, it took nearly an hour to push them, one by one, up the bank to the tree. Next, Glass searched for the three sticks he needed to support the deadfalls. The downed cottonwood provided an array of choices. He selected three branches, about an inch in diameter, and broke them off at a span about the length of his arm. Next, he broke the three sticks in two. Snapping the first stick sent a jarring pain through his shoulder and back, so the next two he leaned against the cottonwood and broke with one of his rocks. When he was finished, he had a stick broken in two for each trap. Reassembled at the break, the broken stick would support, albeit precariously, the weight of the leaning rock. Where the two pieces of the support stick came together, Glass would wedge a baited trigger stick. When the trigger stick was bumped or tugged, the support stick would collapse like a buckling knee, dropping the lethal weight on the unsuspecting target. For the trigger sticks, Glass selected three slender willows, cut to a length of about 16 inches. He had noticed dandelion leaves near the river, and he gathered a large handful to bait the traps, jabbing a number of the tender leaves on each trigger stick. A narrow trail covered with droppings led into the thickest part of the downed cottonwood. Glass selected this location for the first deadfall and began to assemble the components. The difficulty with a deadfall lay in striking a balance between stability and fragility. Stability kept the trap from collapsing on its own, though too much would prevent it from collapsing at all. Fragility allowed the trap to collapse easily when tripped by its prey, though too much would cause it to collapse on its own. Striking this balance required strength and coordination, and Glass's wounds robbed him of both. His right arm could not support the weight of the rock, so he perched it clumsily against his right leg. Meanwhile, he struggled with his left hand to hold the two pieces of the support stick with the trigger stick wedged in between. Again and again, the entire structure collapsed. Twice, he decided that he had set the trap too firmly and knocked it down himself. After nearly an hour, he finally struck a proper balance point. He found two more suitable locations on the trails near the cottonwood and set the other deadfalls, then retreated away from the cottonwood toward the river. Glass found a sheltered spot against a cutbank. When he could no longer stand the pangs of hunger, he ate the bitter roots from the dandelions he had plucked for the traps. He drank from the river to wash the taste from his mouth and lay down to sleep. Rabbits were most active at night. He would check the deadfalls in the morning. Sharp pain in his throat awakened Glass before dawn. The first light of the new day seeped like blood into the eastern horizon. Glass shifted his position in an unsuccessful effort to relieve the pain in his shoulder. As the pain eased, he became aware of the chill in the early morning air. He hunched his shoulders and pulled his shredded blanket tightly around his neck. He lay there uncomfortably for an hour, waiting for sufficient light to check the traps. The bitter taste still lingered in his mouth as he crawled toward the downed cottonwood. He was vaguely aware of the rotten stench of skunk. Both of these sensations evaporated as he imagined a rabbit roasting on a spit above a crackling fire. the nourishment of flesh. He could smell it, taste it. From 50 yards, Glass could see all three deadfalls. One stood unmoved, but the other two had been tripped. Their rocks lay flat on the ground. The support sticks collapsed. Glass could feel his pulse pounding in his throat as he crawled hurriedly forward. 10 feet from the first trap, he noticed the multitude of new tracks on the narrow game trail, the scattered piles of fresh scat. His breath grew short as he peered around the backside of the rock. Nothing protruded. He lifted the rock, still hopeful. The trap was empty. His heart sank in disappointment. Did I set it too finely? Did it collapse on its own? He crawled rapidly to the other rock. Nothing protruded from the front. He strained to see around to the blind side of the trap. He saw a flash of black and white and heard a hiss, barely perceptible. Pain registered before his mind could grasp what had happened. The deadfall had pinned a skunk by its foreleg, but the animal's capacity to spew forth a noxious spray was very much alive. It felt as if burning lamp oil had been poured into his eyes. He rolled backward in a futile effort to avoid more of the vapor. Completely blind, he half-crawled, half-rolled toward the river. He crashed into a deep pool by the bank, desperately seeking to wash away the searing spray. With his face underwater, Glass attempted to open his eyes, but the burning was too intense. It took 20 minutes before he could see again, and then only by squinting painfully through blood-red, watery slits. Finally, Glass crawled to the bank. The nauseating reek of the skunk scent clung to his skin and clothing like frost on a window pane. He had once watched a dog roll in the dirt for a week trying to rid itself of skunk. Like the dog, he knew the stink would ride him for days. As the burning in his eyes slowly subsided, Glass took a quick inventory of his wounds. He touched his neck and looked at his fingers. There was no blood, though the internal pain continued when he swallowed or inhaled deeply. He realized that he hadn't tried to speak for several days. Tentatively, he opened his mouth and forced air over his voice box. The action produced sharp pain and a pathetic, squeaking whine. He wondered if he would ever be able to speak normally. By craning his neck, he could see the parallel cuts that ran from his throat to his shoulder. Bridger's pine tar still coated the area. His entire shoulder ached, but the cuts appeared to be healing. The puncture wounds on his thigh also looked relatively healthy, although his leg still would not support the weight of his body. From touching his scalp, he could imagine that it looked horrible, but it no longer bled and it caused no pain. Aside from his throat, the area that most concerned him was his back. He lacked the agility to inspect the wounds with his hands, and unable to see them, his mind conjured horrible images. He felt strange sensations that he assumed were the repeated breaking of scabs. He knew that Captain Henry had tied sutures, and he occasionally felt scratching from the loose ends of thread. More than anything, he felt the corrosive void of hunger. He lay on the sandy bank, exhausted and utterly demoralized by this latest turn of events. A clump of yellow flowers stood atop a slender green stalk. The stalk looked like wild onion, but Glass knew better. It was Death Camas. Is it Providence? Had this been placed here for me? Glass wondered how the poison would work. Would he drift off peacefully into a never-ending sleep, or would his body contort in an agonizing death? How different could it be from his current state? At least there would be certainty that the end was coming. As he lay on the riverbank in the early moments of dawn, a fat doe emerged from the willows on the opposite shore. She looked cautiously left and right before stepping forward, haltingly, to drink from the river. She was barely 30 yards away, an easy shot with his rifle. The Anstalt. For the first time that day, he thought about the men who abandoned him. His rage grew as he stared at the doe. Abandonment seemed too benign to describe their treachery. Abandonment was a passive act, running away or leaving something behind. If his keepers had done no more than abandon him, he would at this moment be sighting down the barrel of his gun, about to shoot the deer. He would be using his knife to butcher the animal and sparking his flint against steel to start a fire and cook it. He looked down at himself, wet from head to toe, wounded, reeking from the skunk, the bitter taste of roots still in his mouth. What Fitzgerald and Bridger had done was much more than abandonment, much worse. These were not mere passers-by on the road to Jericho, looking away and crossing to the other side. Glass felt no entitlement to a Samaritan's care, but he did at least expect that his keepers do no harm. Fitzgerald and Bridger had acted deliberately, robbed him of the few possessions he might have used to save himself, and in stealing from him this opportunity, they had killed him, murdered him, as surely as a knife in the heart or a bullet in the brain murdered him, except he would not die. Would not die, he vowed, because he would live to kill his killers. Hugh Glass pushed himself up and continued his crawl down the banks of the Grand. Glass studied the contour of the land in his immediate vicinity. 50 yards away, a gentle swale led down on three sides to a broad, dry gully. Sage and low grasses provided moderate cover. The swale reminded him suddenly of the gently rolling hills along the Arkansas River. He remembered a trap he had once seen set by Pawnee children. For the children, it had been a game. For Glass, the exercise was now deadly serious. He crawled slowly to the bottom of the swale, stopping at the point that seemed like the natural hub. He found a sharp-edged rock and began to dig in the hard-packed, sandy soil. He dug a pit with a 4-inch diameter to the depth of his bicep. Beginning halfway down, he widened the hole so that it was shaped like a wine bottle with the neck at the top. Glass spread the dirt from the hole to conceal the evidence of recent digging. Breathing heavily from the exertion, he stopped to rest. Next, Glass went in search of a large flat rock. He found one about 40 feet from the hole. He also found 3 small rocks, which he placed in a triangular pattern around the hole. The flat rock he set on top like a roof over the hole, with a space underneath creating the illusion of a place to hide. Glass used a branch to camouflage the area around the trap, then crawled slowly away from the hole. In several spots, he saw tiny telltale droppings, a good sign. 50 yards from the hole, he stopped. His knee and palms were raw from crawling, his thigh ached from the motion, and again he felt the awful cracking sensation as the scabbing on his back began to bleed. Stopping provided temporary relief to his wounds, but it also made him aware of his profound fatigue, a low-grade ache that emanated from deep within, then circulated outward. Glass fought the urge to close his eyes and succumb to the beckoning sleep. He knew he could not regain his strength unless he ate. Glass forced himself into a crawling position, paying careful attention to his distance. He moved in a wide circle with the pit he had dug as the center point. It took him 30 minutes to complete a circuit. Again, his body pleaded with him to stop and rest, but he knew that stopping now would undermine the effectiveness of his trap. He kept crawling, spiraling inward toward the pit in ever smaller circles. When he encountered a thick clump of brush, he would stop to shake it. Anything inside his circles was driven slowly toward the hidden pit. An hour later, Glass arrived at his hole. He removed the flat rock from the top and listened. He had seen a Pawnee boy reach his hand into a similar trap and pull it out, screaming with a rattlesnake attached. The boy's error left a strong impression. He looked around for a suitable branch. He found a long one with a flat end and pounded it several times into the hole. Having assured himself that anything in his trap was dead, he reached into the hole. One by one, he pulled out 4 dead mice and 2 ground squirrels. There was no glory in this method of hunting, but Glass was elated with the results. The swale provided some measure of concealment, and Glass decided to risk a fire, cursing the lack of his flint and steel. He knew it was possible to create a flame by rubbing two sticks together, but he had never started a fire that way. He suspected that the method, if it worked at all, would take forever. What he needed was a bow and spindle, a crude machine for making fire. The machine had three parts: a flat piece of wood with a hole where the spindle stick was planted, a round spindle stick about 3/4 inch thick and 8 inches long, and a bow, like a cellist's, to twirl the spindle. Glass searched the gully to find the parts. It wasn't hard to locate a flat piece of driftwood and two sticks for the spindle and the bow. String for the bow. He had no cord. The strap on my bag. He pulled out the razor and sliced the strap from his bag, then tied it to the ends of the stick. Next, he used the razor to carve away the edges for a hole in the flat piece of driftwood, careful to make it slightly bigger than the spindle stick. With the bow and spindle assembled, Glass gathered tinder and fuel. From his possibles bag, he removed the ball patches, ripping them to fray the edges. He also had saved cattail cotton. He piled the tinder loosely in a shallow pit, then added dry grass. To the few pieces of dry wood in the area, he added buffalo dung, bone dry from long weeks in the sun. With the makings of the fire in place, Glass grabbed the components of the bow and spindle. He filled the hole in the flat piece of wood with tinder, set the spindle stick in the hole, and looped the bowstring around it. He held the spindle stick against the palm of his right hand, still protected by the woolen pad he used to crawl. With his left hand, he worked the bow. The back-and-forth motion spun the spindle in the hole on the flat driftwood, creating friction and heat. The fault in his machine became immediately apparent as he spun the spindle with the bow stick. One end of the spindle rubbed in the hole on the flat driftwood, the end where he wanted to create the fire. The other end, though, spun against the flesh of his hand. Glass remembered that the Pawnee used a palm-sized piece of wood to hold the top end of the spindle. He searched again to find the right piece of wood. He located an appropriate chunk and used the razor to carve away a hole for the top of the spindle stick. He was clumsy with his left hand, and it took several attempts to find the right rhythm, moving the bow in a steady motion without losing his grip on the spindle stick. Soon, though, he had the spindle twirling smoothly. After several minutes, smoke began to rise from the hole. Suddenly, the tinder burst into flames. He grabbed cattail cotton and set it to the lick of flame, protecting it with a cupped hand. When the cotton caught fire, he transferred the flame to the tinder in the small pit. He felt the wind whip across his back and panicked for an instant that it would extinguish the flame. But the tinder caught, then the dry grass. In a few minutes, he was feeding the buffalo chips into a small blaze. There wasn't much meat left by the time he skinned the tiny rodents and removed their entrails. Still, it was fresh. If his trapping technique was time-consuming, at least it had the benefit of simplicity. Glass was still ravenous as he picked at the tiny rib cage of the last rodent. He resolved to stop earlier the next day, perhaps dig pits in two locations. The thought of slower progress irritated him. How long could he avoid a Ricara on the banks of the well-traveled Grand? Don't do that. Don't look too far ahead. The goal each day is tomorrow morning. With his dinner cooked, the fire no longer merited its risk. He covered it with sand and went to sleep. 10. September 15th, 1823. Twin buttes framed the valley in front of Glass, forcing the Grand River through a narrow channel between. Glass remembered the buttes from the trip upriver with Captain Henry. As he crawled farther east along the Grand, distinctive features became increasingly rare. Even the cottonwoods seemed to have been swallowed by the sea of prairie grass. Henry and the Fur Brigade had camped near the buttes, and Glass intended to stop in the same spot, hoping that something useful might have been left behind. In any event, he remembered that the high bank near the buttes made good shelter. Great stacks of black thunderheads sat ominously on the western horizon. The storm would be overhead in a couple of hours, and he wanted to dig in before it hit. Glass crawled along the river to the campsite. A ring of blackened stones marked a recent fire. He remembered that the fur brigade had camped with no fire and wondered who had followed behind them. He stopped, removed the possible's bag and blanket from his back, and took a long drink from the river. Behind him, the cut bank created the shelter he remembered. He scanned up and down the river, watchful for signs of Indians, disappointed that the vegetation looked sparse. He felt the familiar rumble of hunger and wondered if there was enough cover to dig an effective mouse pit. Is it worth the effort? He weighed the benefits of shelter against the benefits of food. Rodents had sustained him now for a week. Still, Glass knew he was treading water, not drowning, but making no progress toward a safer shore. A light breeze heralded the approaching clouds, cool across the sweat on his back. Glass turned from the river and crawled up the high bank to check on the storm. What lay beyond the rim of the bank took his breath away. Thousands of buffalo grazed in the vale below the butte, blackening the plain for a solid mile. A great bull stood sentry no more than 50 yards in front of him. The animal stood close to 7 feet at the hump. The shaggy shawl of tawny fur on top of its black body accentuated the powerful head and shoulders, making the horns seem almost redundant. The bull snorted and sniffed at the air, frustrated by the swirling breeze. Behind the bull, a cow wallowed on her back, lifting a cloud of dust. A dozen other cows and calves grazed obliviously nearby. Glass had glimpsed his first buffalo on the Texas plains. Since then, he had seen them, in herds great and herds small, on 100 different occasions. Yet the sight of the animals never failed to fill him with awe. Awe for their infinite numbers, awe for the prairie that sustained them. 100 yards downstream from Glass, a pack of 8 wolves also watched the great bull and the outliers he guarded. The alpha male sat on his haunches near a clump of sage. All afternoon, he had waited patiently for the moment that just arrived, the moment when a gap emerged between the outliers and the rest of the herd. A gap, a fatal weakness. The big wolf raised himself suddenly to all fours. The alpha male stood tall, but narrow. His legs seemed ungainly, knobby, and somehow oddly proportioned to his coal-black body. His 2 pups wrestled playfully near the river. Some of the wolves lay sleeping, placid as barnyard hounds. Taken together, the animals seemed more like pets than predators, though they all perked to life at the sudden movement from the big male. It wasn't until the wolves began to move that their lethal strength became obvious. The strength was not derivative of muscularity or grace. Rather, it flowed from a single-minded intelligence that made their movements deliberate, relentless. The individual animals converged into a lethal unit, cohering in the collective strength of the pack. The alpha male trotted toward the gap between the outliers and the herd, breaking into a full run after a few yards. The pack fanned out behind him with a precision and unity of purpose that struck Glass as almost military. The pack poured into the gap. Even the pups seemed to grasp the purpose of their enterprise. Buffalo on the edge of the main herd retreated, pushing their calves in front of them before turning outward, shoulder to shoulder, in a line against the wolves. The gap widened with the movement of the main herd, stranding the bull and a dozen other buffalo outside its perimeter. The great bull charged, catching one wolf with its horn and tossing the yelping animal 20 feet. The wolves snarled and growled, snapping with brutal fangs at exposed flanks. Most of the outliers broke for the main herd, realizing instinctively that their safety lay in numbers. The alpha male nipped at the tender haunch of a calf. Confused, the calf broke away from the herd toward the steep bank by the river. Collectively aware of the deadly error, the pack fell instantly behind its prey. Bawling as it ran, the calf dashed wildly ahead. It tumbled over the bank, snapping its leg in the fall. The calf struggled to regain its feet. Its broken leg dangled in an odd direction and then collapsed completely when the calf tried to plant it. The calf fell to the ground, and the pack was on it. Fangs planted themselves in every part of its body. The alpha male sunk its teeth into the tender throat and ripped. The calf's last stand took place no more than 75 yards down the bank from Glass. He watched with a mixture of fascination and fear, glad that his vantage point lay downwind. The pack focused its complete attention on the calf. The alpha male and his mate ate first, their bloody snouts buried in the soft underbelly. They let the pups eat, but not the others. Occasionally, another wolf would slink up to the fallen prey, only to be sent scrambling by a snap or snarl from the big black male. Glass stared at the calf and the wolves, his mind turning quickly. The calf had been dropped in the spring. After a summer of fattening on the prairie, it weighed close to 150 pounds. 150 pounds of fresh meat. After 2 weeks of catching his food by the mouthful, Glass could scarcely imagine such bounty. Initially, Glass had hoped that the pack might leave enough for him to scavenge. As he continued to watch, though, the bounty diminished at an alarming rate. Satiated, the alpha male and his mate eventually wandered casually away from the carcass, with a severed hindquarter in tow for the pups. The four other wolves fell on the carcass. In growing desperation, Glass considered the options. If he waited too long, he doubted whether anything would be left. He weighed the prospect of continuing to live off mice and roots. Even if he could find enough to sustain himself, the task took too much time. He doubted he had covered 30 miles since beginning his crawl. At his current pace, he would be lucky to reach Fort Kiowa before cold set in. And of course, every day of exposure on the river was another day for Indians to stumble upon him. He desperately needed the certain strength that the buffalo meat would give him. He did not know by what providence the calf had been placed in his path. This is my chance. If he wanted his share of the calf, he would have to fight for it, and he needed to do it now. He scanned the area for the makings of some weapon. Nothing presented itself beyond rocks, driftwood, and sage. A club? He wondered for a moment if he could beat back the wolves. It seemed implausible. He couldn't swing hard enough to inflict much of a blow, and from his knees, he forfeited any advantage of height. Sage. He remembered the brief but impressive flames created by dry sage branches. A torch? Seeing no other option, he scurried around him for the makings of a fire. The spring floods had tossed the trunk of a large cottonwood against the cut bank, creating a natural windbreak. Glass scooped a shallow pit in the sand next to the trunk. He took out his bow and spindle, grateful that he at least had the means for quickly creating a flame. From the possibles bag, he removed the last of the patches and a large clump of cattail cotton. Glass looked downriver at the wolf pack, still ripping at the calf. Damn it. He looked around him for fuel. The river had left little of the cottonwood beyond the trunk. He found a clump of dead sage and snapped off five large branches, piling them next to the fire pit. Glass set the bow and spindle in the sheltered pit, carefully placing the tinder. He began to work the bow, slowly at first, then faster as he found his rhythm. In a few minutes, he had a low fire burning in the pit by the cottonwood. He looked downriver toward the wolves. The alpha male, his mate, and their two pups huddled together about 20 yards beyond the calf. Having taken first dibs at the calf, they now were content to gnaw casually at the tasty marrow of the hindquarter. Glass hoped they would stay out of the coming battle. That left four wolves on the carcass itself. The Loup Pawnee, as their name implied, revered the wolf for its strength and, above all, for its cunning. Glass had been with Pawnee hunting parties that shot wolves. Their hides were an important part of many ceremonies. But he had never done anything like what he prepared to do at that moment. Crawl into a pack of wolves and challenge them for food, armed only with a torch of sage. The five sage branches twisted like giant arthritic hands. Smaller twigs extended from the main branches at frequent intervals, most of them covered with spindly strands of bark and brittle blue-green leaves. He grabbed one of the branches and set it to the fire. It caught immediately, a foot-high flame soon roaring from its top. "It's burning too fast." Glass wondered if the flame would last the distance between him and the wolves, let alone provide a weapon in whatever struggle that lay before him. He decided to hedge his bet. Rather than lighting all of the sage now, he would carry most of the branches unlit, backup ammunition to be added to the torch as needed. Glass looked again at the wolves. They suddenly seemed larger. He hesitated for an instant. No turning back, he decided. This is my chance. With the burning sage branch in one hand and the four backup branches in the other, Glass crawled down the bank toward the wolves. At 50 yards, the alpha male and his mate looked up from the hindquarter to stare at this strange animal approaching the buffalo calf. They viewed Glass as a curiosity, not a challenge. After all, they had eaten their fill. At 20 yards, the wind shifted, and the four animals on the carcass caught scent of the smoke. They all turned. Glass stopped, face to face now with four wolves. From a distance, it was easy to see the wolves as mere dogs. Up close, they bore no relation to their domestic cousins. A white wolf showed its bloody teeth and took a half step toward Glass, a deep growl pouring from its throat. It lowered its shoulder, a move that seemed somehow both defensive and offensive at the same time. The white wolf fought conflicting instincts, one defensive of its prey, the other afraid of fire. A second wolf, this one missing most of one ear, fell in beside the first. The other two continued to rip at the buffalo carcass, appreciative, it seemed, of the exclusive attention to the calf. The burning branch in Glass's right hand began to flicker. The white wolf took another step toward Glass, who remembered suddenly the sickening sensation of the bear's teeth ripping at his flesh. What have I done? Suddenly, there was a flash of bright light, a brief pause, and then the deep bass of thunder rolling down the valley. A raindrop struck Glass's face, and the wind whipped at the flame. He felt a sickening churn in his stomach. God, no, not now. He had to act quickly. The white wolf was poised to attack. Could they really smell fear? He had to do the unexpected. He had to attack them. He grabbed the four sage branches from his right hand and added them to the burning branch in his left. Flames leapt up, hungrily swallowing the dry fuel. It took both hands now to hold the branches together, which meant he could no longer use his left hand for balance. Excruciating pain extended outward from his wounded right thigh as weight shifted to his leg, and he almost fell. He managed to stay upright as he lurched, hobbling forward on his knees in his best approximation of a charge. He let loose the loudest sound he could muster, which came out as a sort of eerie wail. Forward he moved, swinging the burning torch like a fiery sword. He thrust the torch toward the wolf with one ear. Flames singed the animal's face, and it jumped backward with a yelp. The white wolf leapt at Glass's flank, sinking its teeth into his shoulder. Glass pivoted, craning his neck to keep the wolf off his throat. Only a few inches separated Glass's face from the wolf's, and he could smell the animal's bloody breath. Glass struggled again to keep his balance. He swung his arms around to bring the flames in contact with the wolf, burning the animal's belly and groin. The wolf released its grip on his shoulder, retreating a step. Glass heard a snarl behind him and ducked instinctively. The one-eared wolf came tumbling over his head, missing his strike at Glass's neck, but knocking Glass to his side. He groaned at the impact of the fall, which reignited pain in his back, throat, and shoulder. The bundled torch hit the ground, spilling on the sandy soil. Glass grasped at the branches, desperate to pick them up before they extinguished. At the same time, he struggled to regain the upright position on his knees. The two wolves circled slowly, waiting for their moment, more cautious now that they had tasted the flame. I can't let them get behind me. Lightning struck again, followed rapidly this time by the boom of thunder. The storm was nearly over him. Rain would pour down at any minute. There's no time. Even without the rain, the flames on the torch were burning low. The white wolf and the wolf with one ear closed. They, too, seemed to sense that the battle was nearing its climax. Glass feigned at them with the torch. They slowed, but did not retreat. Glass had worked himself into a position only a few feet from the calf. The two wolves, feeding on the carcass, succeeded in tearing off a hindquarter and retreated from the commotion of the battling wolves and the strange creature with the fire. For the first time, Glass noticed the clumps of dry sage around the carcass. Would they burn? Eyes fixed on the two wolves, Glass set his torch to the sage. There had been no rain for weeks. The brush was dry as tinder and caught fire easily. In an instant, flames rose 2 feet above the sage next to the carcass. Glass lit two other clumps. Soon, the carcass lay in the middle of 3 burning bushes. Like Moses, Glass planted himself with his knees on the carcass, waving the remnants of his torch. Lightning struck and thunder boomed. Wind whipped the flames around the brush. Rain fell now, though not yet enough to douse the sage. The effect was impressive. The white wolf and the wolf with one ear looked around. The alpha male, his mate and the pups, loped across the prairie. With full bellies and a breaking storm, they headed for the shelter of their nearby den. The other two wolves from the carcass also followed, struggling to pull the calf's hindquarter across the prairie. The white wolf crouched, poised, it seemed, to attack again. But suddenly the wolf with one ear turned and ran after the pack. The white wolf stopped to contemplate the changing odds. He knew well his place in the pack. Others led, and he followed. Others picked out the game to be killed. He helped to run it down. Others ate first. He contented himself with the remainder. The wolf had never seen an animal like the one that appeared today, but he understood precisely where it fit in the pecking order. Another clap of thunder erupted overhead, and the rain began to pour down. The white wolf took one last look at the buffalo, the man, and the smoking sage. Then he turned and loped after the others. Glass watched the wolves disappear above the rim of the cutbank. Around him, smoke rose as the rain doused the sage. Another minute, and he would be defenseless. He marveled at his fortune as he glanced quickly at the bite on his shoulder. Blood trickled from 2 puncture wounds, but they were not deep. The calf lay in the grotesque throes of its failed efforts to escape the wolves. Brutally efficient fangs had ripped the carcass open. Fresh blood pooled beneath the open throat, an eerily brilliant crimson against the muted tans of the sand in the gully. The wolves had focused their attention on the rich entrails that Glass himself craved. He rolled the calf from its side to its back, noting with brief disappointment that nothing remained of the liver. Gone, too, were the gallbladder, the lungs, and the heart. But a small bit of intestine hung from the animal. Glass removed the razor from his possibles bag, followed the snaking organ into the body cavity with his left hand, and cut a 2-foot length at the stomach. Barely able to control himself at the immediacy of food, he put the cut end to his mouth and guzzled. If the wolf pack had availed itself of the choicer organs, it also had done Glass the favor of nearly skinning its prey. Glass moved to the throat, where, with the aid of the razor, he could pull back the supple skin. The calf was well fed. Delicate, white fat clung to the muscle of its plump neck. The trappers called this fat fleece and considered it a delicacy. He cut chunks and stuffed them into his mouth, barely chewing before he swallowed. Each swallow revived the excruciating fire in his throat, but hunger trumped the pain. He gorged himself in the pouring rain, arriving finally at some minimal threshold that allowed him to consider other dangers. Glass climbed again to the rim of the cutbank, scanning the horizon in all directions. Scattered clumps of buffalo grazed obliviously, but there was no sign of wolf or Indian. The rain and thunder had ended, blowing past as rapidly as they appeared. Angled rays of afternoon sunlight succeeded in breaking through the great thunderheads, streaming forth in iridescent rays extending from heaven to earth. Glass settled back to consider his fortune. The wolves had taken their share, but an enormous resource lay below him. Glass suffered no illusions about his situation. But he would not starve. Glass camped for 3 days on the cutbank next to the calf. For the first few hours, he didn't even set a fire, gorging uncontrollably on thin slices of the gloriously fresh meat. Finally, he paused long enough to start a low blaze for roasting and drying, concealing the flames as much as possible by setting them near to the bank. He built racks from the green branches of a nearby stand of willows. Hour after hour, he carved away at the carcass with the dull razor, hanging meat on the racks while he steadily fed the fires. In 3 days, he dried 15 pounds of jerky, enough to sustain him for 2 weeks if need be, longer if he could supplement along the way. The wolves did leave one choice cut, the tongue. He relished this delicacy like a king. The ribs and remaining leg bones he roasted on the fire one by one, cracking them for their rich, fresh marrow. Glass removed the hide with the dull razor, a task that should have taken minutes, took hours, an interval during which he thought bitterly about the 2 men who stole his knife. He had neither the time nor the tools to work the fur properly, but he did cut a crude parfleche before the skin dried into stiff rawhide. He needed the bag to carry the jerky. On the 3rd day, Glass went searching for a long branch to use as a crutch. In the fight with the wolves, he had been surprised at the weight that his wounded leg could support. He had exercised the leg over the past 2 days, stretching and testing it. With the aid of a crutch, Glass believed he could now walk upright, a prospect he relished after 3 weeks of crawling like a gimpy dog. He found a cottonwood branch of the appropriate length and shape. He cut a long strip from the Hudson Bay blanket, wrapping it around the top of the crutch as a pad. The blanket had been reduced, strip by strip, to a piece of cloth no more than 1 foot wide by 2 feet long. Glass used the razor to cut an opening in the middle of the cloth, large enough so that he could poke his head through. The resulting garment wasn't big enough to call a capote, but at least it would cover his shoulders and keep the parfleche from digging against his skin. There was a chill in the air again on that last night by the buttes. The last shreds of the slaughtered calf hung drying on the racks above the crimson coals. The fire cast a comforting glow on his camp, a tiny oasis of light amid the black of the moonless plain. Glass sucked the marrow from the last of the ribs. As he tossed the bone on the fire, he realized suddenly that he was not hungry. He savored the seeping warmth of the fire, a luxury he would not enjoy again in the foreseeable future. 3 days of food had worked to repair his wounded body. He bent his right leg to test it. The muscles were tight and sore, but functional. His shoulder, too, had improved. Strength had not returned to his arm, but some flexibility had. It still scared him to touch his throat. The remnants of the stitches protruded, although the skin had fused. He wondered if he should attempt to cut them away with the razor, but had been afraid to try. Aside from his effort to yell at the wolves, he had not tested his voice for days. He would not do so now. His voice had little to do with his survival in the coming weeks. If it were changed, so be it. He did appreciate the fact that he now could swallow with less pain. Glass knew that the buffalo calf had turned his fortune. Still, it was easy to temper the assessment of where he stood.